Harper Audio presents Extraordinary Means by Robin Schneider, performed by James Foey and Christine Van. Chapter 1. Lane. My first night at Latham House, I lay awake in my narrow, gabled room in Cottage 6, wondering how many people had died in it. And I didn't just wonder this casually, either. I did the math. I figured the probability. And I came up with a number. 8. But then, I've always been terrible at math. In 4th grade, we had to do timed tests for our multiplication tables. 5 minutes a page, 50 questions each. And if you wanted to move on, you couldn't make a single mistake. The teacher charted our progress on a piece of hot pink poster board taped up for everyone to see, a smiley face sticker next to our name for each table we completed. I watched as the number of stickers next to everyone else's names grew, while I got stuck on the 7s. I did the flashcards every night, but it was no use, because it wasn't the multiplication table that was giving me trouble. It was the pressure of being told 2 things. 1, that I only had a short amount of time, and 2, that I had to get everything right. When I finally drifted off to sleep, I dreamed of houses falling into the ocean and drowning. The water swallowed them, but they rose up again from the black depths, rotting and covered in seaweed, as they rode the waves back to shore looking for their owners. I'm an only child, so the prospect of using the communal bathroom was pretty horrifying, which is why I set my alarm that first morning for 6 o'clock, tiptoeing down the hall with my dop kit and towel while everyone else was still asleep. It was strange wearing shoes in the shower, being completely naked except for a pair of flip-flops, washing my hair with shoes on and doing it in a Tupperware container of a shower stall felt so different from my normal Monday morning routine that I wondered if I'd ever get used to it. I used to sleep in at home, waiting until the last possible moment to roll out of bed, grope for a clean shirt, and eat a cereal bar on the drive to school. I'd listen to whatever songs were on the radio, not because I liked them, but because they were my tarot cards. If the songs were good, it would be a good day. If they were bad, I'd probably get a B on a quiz. But that morning, standing at the window of my dorm room as I buttoned my shirt, I felt like an entirely different person. It was as though someone had taken an eraser to my life and, instead of getting rid of the mess, had rubbed away all the parts that I'd wanted to keep. Now, instead of my girlfriend and my dog and my car, I had a pale green vinyl mattress, a view of the woods, and an ache in my chest. I'd gotten in late the night before. My parents drove me up, Dad clutching the steering wheel, and Mom staring straight ahead as we listened to NPR for 6 hours with the windows down, not saying anything. Dinner was long over, and it was almost lights out by the time I'd opened my suitcase. Latham still didn't feel real. Not yet. I'd encountered it, tiptoeing around the corridors out of sync with the rest of its residents, but I hadn't yet become one of them. It was the end of September, and I was 17, and my senior year was taking place 400 miles away, without me. I tried not to think about that as I waited for my tour guide outside the dormitory, in the early morning chill of the mountains. I tried not to think about any of it, because I was pretty sure the full weight of my situation would crush me. Instead, I thought about wet flip-flops and math problems and my cell phone, which I'd had for a few brief hours in the car and which had been taken from me upon arrival. According to my information packet, your first day ambassador, Grant Hardin, will meet you outside your dorm at 7:55 a.m. to take you to breakfast and help you find your first class. So I waited for Grant to show up while everyone else streamed past me, shuffling toward the dining hall in a motley assortment of sweatpants and pajamas, like we were at summer camp. Of course, Grant was running late, so I stood there forever, getting more and more annoyed. It seemed ridiculous that I couldn't just find my own way to breakfast, or to Latham's one academic building, that I needed to be publicly escorted. I glanced at my wrist. 8:09. I didn't know how much longer I was reasonably expected to stand there, so I waited another few minutes, then gave up and walked to the dining hall. It was easy enough to find the place, to pick up a tray and join the line of half-asleep teenagers. I was right. I hadn't needed some kid to show me around after all. It was just a cafeteria line. I took a bowl of cereal and a little milk carton, noting that my old high school had carried the same brand of milk, featuring this weird, grinning cow's head. How strange. For everything to shift so drastically, but for the milk cartons to stay the same. I slid my tray along the counter, past the plates of eggs and muffins and toast. But it wasn't until I heard someone yell for a friend to save him a seat that I realized my mistake. I was totally alone. I'd been so impatient to get to the dining hall that I hadn't thought it through. Maybe if I'd gone into the bathroom that morning along with everyone else, pitching myself into the chaos instead of avoiding it, I could have found someone to walk over with. Now, I didn't even know who lived on my floor, and I was fast approaching the front of the line without even a cell phone to rescue me from the total disaster of having nowhere to sit in a crowded dining hall. I was thinking that I couldn't have screwed this up worse when the nutritionist frowned down at my tray like I'd personally disappointed her with my choice of breakfast cereal. "That's it?" she asked. "I'm not really hungry." I never was in the mornings. My appetite usually slept in until noon. "I can't sign off on this," she said, as though I should have known better. "If you're too unwell to eat a full meal, you talk to the hall nurse before breakfast." Too unwell. God, how embarrassing. "It's my first day," I said desperately. "I didn't know." I glanced behind me, uncomfortably aware that I was holding up the line. Way to make an impression. I hadn't known it was possible to fail breakfast. Actually, I should have known. Grant should have told me. "You can go back through for some protein, or you can take a strike." She glared at me, all pursed lips and leathery tanned skin, waiting. The thought of slinking to the back of the line with everyone watching filled me with a sense of horror. She couldn't mean it. But apparently she did. "Well?" the nutritionist asked. I wished I were the sort of guy who'd take a strike, whatever that meant, just to prove that I didn't have to play by the system. But I wasn't. At least, not yet. I was a head-down and grades-up sort of guy. When the warning bell rang, I hustled. When the Scantron tests were given, I brought a spare number 2 pencil. And so, with everyone watching, I took a deep breath and went to the back of the line. "That was brutal," the boy in front of me said. He was my age, a pudgy Indian kid with a pair of old-fashioned glasses and a mess of black hair. Even at 8 a.m., he was all nervous energy. "Not many people can say they've flunked breakfast on their first day." "I didn't do the homework," I said. "I had too much on my plate." He grinned, picking up on the pun. "Or apparently not enough," he said. "I'm Nikhil. Everyone calls me Nick." "I'm Lane." "So Lane," he said. "Here's a crash course on meals. You take a dish from each station. You don't have to eat it all. Hell, you could sculpt the Colosseum out of eggs and toast, but you take full plates and bring back empty ones." "Doesn't that defeat the purpose of having a nutritionist?" I asked. Precisely, which is where the plan comes in.
We have a plan?
We do indeed. Because lovely old Linda up there told you to go back for more, but she didn't tell you how much more. I saw where he was going with this immediately.
Oh, no, I said. I'm not really...
You're looking pretty hungry there, Lane. Nick grinned hugely as he slung a plate of scrambled eggs onto my tray. Before I could protest, he'd topped the scrambled eggs with hard-boiled ones. I looked down at my tray. The damage was done. I'd been egged. And so, with Nick egging me on, I added a stack of toast.
Perfect, he said.
Now, how about a muffin?
He reached into the case and held up an entire platter, offering it to me with a flourish.
How about two? I said.
We were halfway to the front when the line stopped moving again.
You can't be serious, the nutritionist said. Everyone craned forward to see what was going on.
It was a girl. She was small and blonde with a messy ponytail. On her tray was a single mug of tea.
So give me a strike,
the girl said. It sounded like a challenge.
Go back through.
You and I both know there isn't enough time for that, the girl said. It was true. There were maybe 20 minutes before we had to head to class.
My tea's getting cold, so if you don't mind, said the girl.
She held out her wrist with the black silicone bracelet, daring the nutritionist to scan it. The dining hall was silent. We were all watching to see what Linda would do. And then she scanned the girl through, typing furiously into the computer bank.
Strike two this month, Sadie, she warned.
Ooh, after my third strike, do I get out?
The girl asked, laughing. She exited the line in triumph, the mug of tea in front of her like a trophy. As she walked toward the tables, I saw her full on for the first time. She was a miraculous, early morning kind of pretty, with a ponytail she'd probably slept in and a sweater slipping off one shoulder. Her lips were painted red, and her mouth quirked up at the corner. And she looked like the last girl you'd expect to start trouble in the cafeteria on a Monday morning. But that wasn't why I was staring. There was something oddly familiar about her. I had the unshakable impression that I'd seen her somewhere before, that we'd already met. And then I realized we had. At Camp Griffith, 4 years ago. That awful place in Los Padres my parents had shipped me off to when I was younger so they could go on vacation without me.
Well, that's the other way to handle it, Nick said, interrupting my train of thought.
Belatedly, I realized he was talking about Sadie.
Won't she get in trouble?
I asked.
Of course, Nick snorted, but Sadie only gets in trouble when she wants to.
I didn't know what he meant, and I was about to ask, but we'd reached the front of the line.
Hey there, Linda. Made you a Picasso this morning, Nick smirked, presenting the nutritionist with his tray, upon which he'd arranged his tofu sausage, eggs, and English muffin into the unmistakable shape of a penis.
I was scanned through with equal disgust and was about to follow Nick over to his group of friends when he gave me a chin nod and said,
You probably want to catch up with your tour guide and kick his ass for not warning you about the food stations, huh?
Something like that, I mumbled.
Well, I'll see you around.
Before I could answer, he was gone. I stood there alone, trying not to despair, as my unwanted breakfast slid around on my tray. It was too dark inside the dining hall, the paneled wood and brass chandeliers swallowing all sense of time. The tables were small, round things, 6 seats each like some disastrous King Arthur's court. I thought longingly of Harbor High, with its palm trees and plastic-wrapped sandwiches, where my group and I hung out in the little courtyard behind the science labs. We were the marginally acceptable AP crowd. Liked enough to hold officer positions in the Model United Nations Club, but not on the radar for something like Student Council. Most days, my girlfriend and I would check homework answers or study for next period, and we'd pass a can of Coke back and forth while we ate our sandwiches. It wasn't the kind of group where we hung out at each other's houses, but I'd never once doubted that I had a place to sit. I watched as Nick joined Sadie's table, striking a pose with his breakfast art that made everyone laugh. I understood then that he hadn't made the plate of, junk food to piss off the nutritionist. He'd made it to amuse his friends. There were still two seats left, but Nick hadn't invited me to join him, and anyway, they probably belonged to people who were still in line. I hoped that my missing tour guide would see me standing there and wave me over to his table with a sheepish apology, but no such luck. The 2.5 breakfasts on my tray were starting to get heavy, and I had to put the thing down somewhere. So I took a deep breath and walked to the back of the dining hall like I knew where I was going. I sat down randomly at a table with four empty seats and two boys intensely playing a game of travel chess, who seemed to be off in their own world. I sighed and poured my milk into my cereal, dumping in the whole carton instead of trying to get the proportions right. The Cheerios floated to the top, bobbing like empty life rafts.
"Hi, I'm Genevieve. Are you new?"
a girl asked, taking the seat next to mine. Her smile was friendly, but there was something about the combination of freckles and ponytail and teeth that made me certain she had a dozen horse-riding ribbons pinned over her desk. "First day," I said.
"You'll love it here," she promised. "What's your dorm?"
Six," I said.
"Johnson 6,"
she said, as though this was the biggest coincidence in the world.
"He's my boyfriend. He'll be here in a minute. The line's taking forever today."
I was at the wrong table. I knew it then as the girl introduced me to John, her acne-ravaged boyfriend, and to Tim and Chris, the two chess players I had mistakenly assumed were sitting by themselves, not waiting for the rest of their group.
"Are you really going to eat all that?"
John asked, staring at my tray.
"It's a joke," I explained half-heartedly. "The nutritionist said..."
"Oh, you don't want to make her mad," Genevieve warned. "She'll give you a strike against privileges, and if you get 3 in a month, you're banned from the social."
"The social?" I asked.
"Didn't your tour guide tell you anything?"
Genevieve asked.
"Not really," I said, not wanting to get into it.
"Oh, well, we get some big activity every month," Genevieve explained.
"I think this time it's line dancing,"
John put in, sounding scarily excited. I snorted. No wonder Sadie had baited the nutritionist. I'd assumed it was detention or chores or whatever else bad kids are punished with, not a free pass for making a fool of yourself to Cotton Eye Joe. But then, Nick had said she only got in trouble when she wanted to. Genevieve launched enthusiastically into a description of line dancing, just in case I wasn't already aware how much I would rather go to the dentist. I smiled and nodded, wishing I could have breakfast in peace. But I was the one who'd sat at their table, and they were just being nice. And as awful as they were, it looked like I could have picked tables far worse. The group to my left was totally checked out, and I couldn't tell if they were just early morning zombies or if the glazed expression was permanent. And on my right was a table of girls who were actively not talking to each other as they glared at their scrambled eggs. I glanced across the dining hall toward Nick and Sadie's table. There was something magnetic about it, about them, even from all the way where I sat in the outer rings. I couldn't figure out what they were. Not that your typical social groups applied at a place like Latham. There were four of them, and they were laughing. Nick had picked up his breakfast sausage and was holding it aloft like an orchestra conductor, waving it slowly and deliberately. Next to me, Genevieve started coughing. She scrambled for a napkin, pressing it over her mouth.
"Sorry," she said. "The orange juice had pulp."
"You okay, Bunny Wunny?"
John asked, rubbing her back.
God, I really had picked a winner of a table.
But something about Genevieve's choking made me realize that beyond the talking and the eating and the scraping of chairs, the dining hall echoed with coughing. It was like a symphony of sickness. I glanced over at Sadie's table again, and sure enough, that's what they were laughing at. Nick, with his tofu sausage, was conducting the coughing. Thankfully, all the classrooms were in the same building, so I found my way to English without too much trouble. It was in a large wood-paneled room with huge open windows, like an atrium. There was an old-fashioned chalkboard and 20 desks. 20. I was used to smart boards, lockers, public school, and something told me that Mr. Holder, a balding crane of a man in a shapeless tweed blazer, had never been near a public school in his life.
Yes,
he asked as I hesitated in the doorway, wondering if seating was assigned. I'm Lane Rosen, I said. I'm new?
Welcome to the rotation, he said grimly. Take the seat next to Mr. Caro.
He pointed toward a sullen-looking boy in the first row. I sat, taking out my notebook and pencil. Holder slapped a copy of Great Expectations and a photocopied packet on my desk.
Read a chapter, answer the questions. Rinse and repeat. When you are done, I'll give you an essay topic, he said, leaving me to it.
I stared down at the paperback on my desk. All around me, students were working. Some of them had different books. I spotted Lord of the Flies, Moby Dick, and The Sun Also Rises. I sighed and opened my packet, skimming the questions so I knew what answers to look for when I started reading, a trick I'd picked up in SAT prep.
When class was over, Holder said, "See you on Wednesday,"
and everyone started to pack up. I was about halfway through the questions for Chapter 2. Wait, I said to the boy next to me, what's the homework?
Good one, he snorted, as though I'd said something funny.
In history, we watched a documentary on the Black Plague and filled in a worksheet during the movie. The teacher didn't even stay in the room. When she left, I expected the class to erupt into chaos. But everyone continued watching, except for a couple of kids who put their heads down on their desks and went to sleep. I sat at the same table for lunch, which I hadn't meant to do, except Genevieve was two places behind me in line, so there really wasn't an exit tactic. I'd hoped my missing tour guide would have found me by now, but no such luck. I could feel the monotony setting in, and I wished it wouldn't. I didn't want to be at Latham. I didn't want this routine of having my meals checked and my teachers write me off at first glance. I wanted to be in third period AP Euro in Mr. Verma's classroom with all the old newspapers framed on the walls where we got pizza the Friday before an exam. Back at Harbor, being an AP was like belonging to the club the teachers liked best. We were going somewhere in life, the teachers said, handing us extra credit assignments instead of detention, study guides instead of busy work. I just never thought that where I was going was Latham House. We took a long break after lunch. As I trudged across the quad toward the cottages, I saw four students cut out toward the woods. Nick and Sadie's crowd. They walked quickly, heads down as though hurrying toward something far more interesting than rest period. And even though they did it in plain sight, no one seemed to care. The eight cottages were arranged in a half moon around a gazebo in desperate need of a paint job. They were more like ski lodges than actual cottages, with dark wood and deep porches and neat rows of windows. Each cottage had around 20 residents, if I had to guess. The first floor was a lounge area with dilapidated plaid sofas, a long study table, and stacks of board games. There was a separate television room and a micro-kitchen, even though we weren't supposed to cook anything. The best places in the lounge had already been staked out by early arrivers. I watched as a group of four Asian kids played a loud game of Settlers of Catan on the rug
and two boys with a deck of magic cards hunched over the coffee table. My new, and hopefully temporary acquaintances from earlier, were setting up a game of Chinese checkers, and they cheerfully waved me over.
"We can play teams," John suggested.
"I should finish unpacking," I said, edging toward the door.
"Well, later then,"
Tim called. Or maybe it was Chris.
I didn't want to stick around long enough to figure it out.
As I made my way back to my room, muffled music and the unmistakable sound effects of video games leaked from behind closed doors. It was reassuring to hear the Smiths and someone's Pokemon battle, for some small part of my day to be normal. I reached into my pocket, forgetting for a moment that it was empty. I felt so lost without my cell phone, like I might get the most important email of my life, and it would just sit there for hours unread. Not that I was expecting an email like that, but still. My room was at the very end of the hall, a corner room. I assumed that was why it was so narrow. Best coffin in the place, I thought, and then instantly hated myself for going there. It wasn't terrible. I mean, sure, all the furniture was miniaturized. There was a twin extra-long bed, which still didn't make it any roomier. I had a massive bed at home, and I loved her dearly. She was my queen, and I was her loyal subject. Well, her loyal subject in exile. At the foot of my mini-bed was a wardrobe that looked suspiciously like a locker, a vestige of when this place had been an all-boys boarding school. I'd tried and failed to squish my still-packed suitcase inside the night before, and had kicked it under the bed in defeat. It stuck out, and I'd already tripped over it. Twice. I also had a wooden desk and chair, and two huge windows that were stuck open permanently for fresh air. The best part about my room, though, was the view. An endless stretch of woods and sky with a distant haze of mountains.
If I hadn't known why we were in the middle of nowhere, it might have been peaceful.
I rummaged through my desk drawers until I found the thick, glossy handbook I'd been given the night before, and climbed into bed to read it. I figured studying the rules was the best thing to do, since I didn't want to accidentally fail breakfast again. God, the handbook was tedious. I could feel myself falling asleep as I read about suggested wellness dress options. I tried to stay awake, but I'd been up for most of the night, and there hadn't been any coffee at breakfast. I woke up, groggy and disoriented. The handbook was on the floor, pages down, like it was trying to scuttle away. I didn't blame it. When I checked my wrist, I realized I'd been out for a while. I stretched and walked over to the window that faced the woods, watching for the four students to return. It was getting late, and I wondered if I'd missed them entirely. We were all supposed to dress out for PE, which was ironically called wellness, by 2:30. Except I wasn't cleared for wellness yet. I was supposed to go to the medical building instead. I was just about to head over when I saw them emerge from a grove of trees. Sadie was out front, an expensive camera swinging over her shoulder. Nick was there too, his horn-rimmed glasses glinting in the sun. Bringing up the rear was this punk kid in black skinny jeans and docks who looked like he was in a band, and a tall black girl who was shaking leaves from the hem of a billowing lace dress like she'd just stepped off the stage in a school play. They strolled back toward the dorms as though they owned the place, and in that moment, they did. I watched as Sadie stopped to take a picture of the group, solemnly raising her camera and fiddling with the lens. Instead of posing, they stopped where they were, as though frozen, letting her capture the moment forever. I remembered at least this much about her. She'd taken photos all the time at summer camp, sneaking out to the woods and disappearing for hours. She was all elbows and skinned knees back then, and I was one of the shortest boys in my cabin. My memories of that summer were hazy,
and mostly had to do with being terrified of this one asshole cabin mate of mine who threatened to piss on everyone's beds if we didn't give him our commissary snacks. We were starting eighth grade in the fall, and almost overnight, everyone had gone from pointing out girls with visible bra straps to girls who were definitely going to blow them after the lower seniors' dance at this rock in the woods. For their sake, I'd hoped the rock had a sign-up sheet. I hadn't exchanged more than a couple of sentences with Sadie. I didn't say much of anything during that terrible summer, where two guys got kicked out of my cabin for stealing, and a disgusting game of soggy cookie had ended so badly that my only real friend went home 2 weeks early, his parents threatening a lawsuit. But I still remembered Sadie, with purple rubber bands in her braces and these tie-dyed shorts, always alone and always stooping to photograph a leaf or a flower. It had seemed impossible that I'd recognize anyone at Latham, that there could be a familiar face up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, hundreds of miles from home. But the more I considered it, the more it made a terrible kind of sense. At Latham House, we were asked to believe in unlikely miracles, in second chances. We woke up each morning hoping that the odds had somehow swung in our favor. But that's the thing about odds. Roll a die twice, and you expect two different results. Except it doesn't work that way. You could roll the same side over and over again. The laws of the universe intact and unchanging with each turn. It's only when you consider the past that the odds change, that things become less and less likely. Here's something I know because I'm a nerd. Up until the middle of the 20th century, dice were made out of cellulose nitrate. It's a material that remains stable for decades, but in a flash, can decompose. The chemical compound breaks down, releasing nitric acid. So, every time you roll a die, there's a small chance that it won't give you a result at all. That instead, it will cleave, crumble, and explode.
Chapter 2. Sadie. We were out in the woods behind the cottages when Nick mentioned what had happened in the breakfast line. It was one of those beautifully crisp fall days that was starting to give way to a warmer afternoon, and we'd all taken off our sweaters and tossed them into a pile with our book bags. Charlie was sitting under a tree, sketching sword ferns. Marina was modeling for me in this great old dress she had, and Nick was sorting leaves that we'd collected, stacking them by color family. "Is this one more jaundice yellow or liver failure yellow?" he asked, holding up a leaf. "I can't look," I said, because I was using a fixed-length lens and had finally managed to get Marina perfectly in frame. "But please tell me you're not sorting them by pathology." "Two pathologies diverged in a yellow wood," Nick said, using his mock trial voice. "And I took the one less traveled." "Ugh, that was awful," Marina complained. "Besides, that's not even the quote."
"Of course it's the quote," Nick said, but he sounded unsure.
"It's two roads diverged," Marina insisted.
"We'll Google it," said Nick. "You'll see."
I laughed because Nick was always doing that, messing up and stubbornly defending himself, like he could argue his way out of being wrong. "The poem is literally called The Road Not Taken," I informed him. "Now, can you put three more leaves on Marina's skirt, the gold-yellow ones?"
"Path, road, lane, whatever,"
he said, adding leaves.
"Actually, that was the new kid's name, Lane, the one I helped piss off the nutritionist."
My camera almost slid off the rock. "Lane Rosen?" I asked.
"I have no clue."
Nick placed the last leaf with a flourish.
"Who introduces themselves with their full name?"
He had a point, but I wasn't going to admit it. "Maybe I will from now on, just to annoy you," I said. I took a test photo to check that it wasn't still blurry, but my lens wasn't the only thing out of focus.
I had to force myself to concentrate because my head was spinning over the possibility. Lane wasn't a common name. I vaguely remembered some hiccup at the front of the line, but I'd figured it was just the nutritionist being a raging bitch, per usual. Not the casual arrival of someone I hadn't thought of in a long time and was perfectly happy never to see again. "Hello, Sadie." Marina sounded like she'd been trying to get my attention for a while. "I asked how it looks." "Sorry," I said, scrolling through the memory card. Hold your right arm a little higher." I took a couple of shots, then made Nick add in some more leaves, even though Marina complained that they'd never come out of her skirt and that her arm ached from holding it up. "Art is pain," I said, mock seriously.
"And so is life," Charlie put in, "which makes life the art from which we are all afflicted."
Huh, that would make such an awesome lyric. I could never tell when Charlie was paying attention. He had the suffering in silence thing down to an art, which actually made sense because he was our group's resident artist. He'd sit there covering his notebook with song lyrics and sketches, all of them dark and painfully brilliant, and then he'd look up and ask something ridiculous, like whether we thought it was possible that dinosaurs had glowed in the dark. "Almost done?" Marina asked. "Almost," I promised. "You look great." She really did. The combination of her dark skin and curly hair and vintage dress covered with leaves was enchanting and almost eerie. Marina did theater back home, designing the costumes. I decided I liked her after I caught her reading a fantasy novel under her desk in Finnegan's class. I'd never had a group of friends like this back in real school. We wouldn't have existed. Charlie would have been some misunderstood loner. Nick would have been off with his mock trial cult, pretending they weren't just a glorified drama club. Marina would have hung around with those backstagey cosplay kids who watch Doctor Who and wear interesting hats, and I would have hung out with the same three girls I'd met in eighth grade, who always seemed to get into relationships with non-statusy boys while I sat there being this mildly entertaining friend who they kept apologizing to when they went on group dates without me. But Latham had reinvented us, made us more offbeat, more interesting, more noticeable than we would have been anywhere else. I'd expected to hate Latham, but I hadn't expected to find friends who hated the exact same things about it, mocking the rules and the teachers and Dr. Barron's until we were laughing so hard we could barely breathe. We'd gone out to the woods because I was finishing up this thematic series, which involved photo manipulations of my friends escaping in fantastical ways. This one was eventually going to be an image of a miniaturized Marina flying away, held aloft by a bunch of balloons, except the balloons would be leaves. A couple of weeks ago, I'd done one of Charlie gliding above the cottages on a paper airplane made of sheet music, and before that, it had been Nick boating across the lake on an antique pocket watch with a twig as a paddle. It had taken forever to put them together in Photoshop. We walked back to the cottages after I got some pictures I thought I could use. I'd wanted to take more, but we still had to change for wellness, and if we waited too long and hurried, it would show on our med sensors. Because Big Brother was always watching. Except we could trick him sometimes, if we were clever enough. And if we timed the distractions perfectly. "So what's the new kid like?" I asked.
"Curious much?" Nick teased, not very nicely.
"I'm just trying to find your replacement," I said, smiling sweetly.
"You couldn't replace me if you tried," Nick boasted.
"I'm impossible to replace. Like a girl's virginity."
"But not a boy's virginity?" I asked.
"Oh, shut up," Nick muttered, embarrassed, as everyone laughed. "Go talk to the new kid yourself if you care so much." "I don't," I said, because being interested wasn't the same thing as caring. Caring meant eagerness, and how I felt about running into Lane was the opposite of eagerness. It was a combination of embarrassment and dread. Dreadbarrassment.
"Something feels off today," Marina announced. I could feel it too, but I hadn't wanted to say anything. And it wasn't just the appearance of the new kid, folded into the rotation with minimum fanfare only weeks after the last dorm lockout. There was a definite ripple, a weirdness, which usually meant one thing at Latham.
"Oh God, who died?"
Nick deadpanned. He was joking, but he wasn't. One day that's not going to be funny, Charlie warned. It wasn't funny now, but we all knew what he meant. We were back by the cottages then, back in time for wellness, like we'd never been gone. Charlie and Marina were lagging behind. Charlie, because he was always stopping to catch his breath, and Marina, because she'd been right. It was going to be hell getting those leaves out of her skirt. "Hey, wait," I said, holding up my camera and documenting the moment. The light was perfect there, slanting through the trees and toward the cottages, and the day was turning unseasonably warm. I could almost imagine that we were at camp, that we'd pull a prank on the counselors and toast s'mores at the campfire, that we'd go home tanned, our clothes smelling of bug spray, that we'd go home. But it was possible not all of us would. 4 out of 5 residents returned home from Latham House. That fact was in the brochure. And it was the part of all this that had struck me the most deeply, deeper than the day I'd fainted in phys ed from the cardio conditioning sprints and wound up in the ER in my embarrassingly unwashed gray jersey gym set, deeper than how Dr. Crane had gotten my test results and staring straight through me had said, "There is an active case of tuberculosis," a sentence hauntingly absent of a pronoun. Like, I had once been there, but my personhood was now irrelevant, because when anyone looked at me from that moment on, all they would see was a grim and incurable disease. In the old days, they used to lay us out on the porch in rows. We'd sleep under the stars in our patient beds, instructed to breathe deeply and to think only of getting better. But that was before first and second-line drug treatments, before scientists developed a cure and the whole thing began to sound ridiculous, as though bored ladies had imagined it in their drawing rooms, gasping in their fashionable corsets, before the disease rose from its ancient grave like some sort of zombie, immune to the drugs that doctors had once fought it with, as it shambled toward our unsuspecting towns, determined to catch its prey young, before it caught me. I'd been at Latham House for more than a year, and time ran slower here. Boredom seeped in, and instead of seeming like there weren't enough hours in a day, it felt like there were far too many. This was my life now, a dining hall that echoed with coughing, and teachers who kept the windows open and made any excuse to leave the room. It was a life of x-rays and nurse checks, of feeling feverish before bed and having an ache in your chest after taking the stairs. Some days were worse, but really, all of them were the same, because every day at Latham was a sick day. I barely remembered what it was like to have homeroom and Twitter and hours of freedom after school let out while my sister was still at gymnastics and before my mom got home from work. And Latham wasn't just a lack of freedom, but a lack of privacy. The med sensors we wore around our wrists at all times saw to that, monitoring our temperatures and heart rates and sleep cycles, and reporting everything back to a remote computer system, as much for our own benefit as for medical research. Dr. Crane had been right. Where I once was, there was now an active case of TB. Everything of who I was and who I wanted to be had been evicted to make room for the disease.
Chapter 3. Lane. One thing I've realized about new places is that they're like jeans. Sure, they might fit, but they're not comfortable. They need time to be broken in. I was thinking about this as I sat in the sterile waiting room of the medical building, trying not to cough from the air conditioning. The whole place smelled like a hospital, a combination of antiseptic and misery. It was completely different from the boarding school atmosphere of the cottages and classrooms. A reminder of what was lurking just around the corner, literally. The posters on the wall, marked with the cross of Lorraine, the skull and crossbones of tuberculosis, urged us to fight the war against contagion, or crusade for a TB-free America. I almost would have preferred a cat telling me to hang in there. At least that would have been generically terrible. Instead, I was staring at posters claiming I was the enemy. I sighed and slouched in my chair, waiting for the nurse to summon me. Up until a few weeks ago, I was a novice at hospitals. Before all this happened,
I'd been to the emergency room exactly twice. Once for an ear infection, and once when I'd wiped out on the quarter pipe in Josh Dow's driveway in seventh grade and broken a bone in my foot. But it's like they say, third time's the charm. A nurse took me back to an exam room, which was even colder than the waiting room. When I sat down on the exam table, the thin paper crackled. I had a theory it was the same paper that covered toilet seats and public restrooms, except on a much larger, much more depressing roll. Once again, my hands itched for my phone. My mom always complained I was addicted to the thing, but that wasn't true. I just didn't like sitting around with nothing to do. Wasting time instead of spending it. It took forever for the doctor to come in, and when he did, he was in a rush. "Sorry for the wait," Dr. Barron said, taking a seat on the little metal stool by the computer. "So, Lane, how are we getting on?" "Fine," I said automatically. "Good, good." He stared at me in this probing, obvious way, and I could tell that despite the friendliness, I was being evaluated. "Tired at all? In any pain?" "No, I'm okay." I mean, I was a little tired from not getting enough sleep, but I wasn't, like, medically exhausted. "On a scale of 1 to 10, he prompted, waiting for a number. 2? "That's what we like to hear," Dr. Barron said, taking out his phone and tapping the screen. "Let me get a read on your vitals here." I stared down at the bracelet on my wrist, black and silicone and bulky. I wasn't used to the thing or how it worked, to give the doctors and nurses most of the data they needed, so they could spend as little time alone with me as possible. It felt strange being recorded, having the way my body worked chronicled in some database that they could pull up on their phones and tablets, either across the room while I was watching, or secretly from rooms away. "Excellent," Dr. Barron said, still looking at his screen. "Now let's see what's going on with those lungs of yours." And then he pivoted toward the computer and pulled up 2 side-by-side x-rays of my chest. 1 from the day in the hospital when I'd been diagnosed, and 1 from the night I arrived at Latham. Dr. Barron's talked a little, gesturing toward the cavities with the tip of his pen like some bizarre PowerPoint presentation where I was both subject and viewer. "This area here is what we need to watch out for, to make sure these 2 lesions in the right lobe don't get any bigger," he said, speaking so slowly and loudly that it was almost insulting. "Can you see what I'm talking about? These black shadows?" I nodded, waiting for him to continue. I didn't need tuberculosis 101. None of this was new to me. Back at St. Luke's, when I'd spent 2 weeks going stir-crazy in the infectious disease ward, I'd at least had the internet to keep me company. And even though I knew Googling total drug-resistant TB wasn't the best idea, I hadn't been able to help myself. So I knew how to identify the small tuberculous lesions on an x-ray. I knew all about how the infection in my lungs affected the red blood cells that passed through them, which was what made this new strain of tuberculosis so much worse than the ones that had come before it. TDR-TB, the news reports called it, since none of the old medications worked on it. But unlike so many other incurable diseases, it was contagious. Whenever I coughed, I put everyone near me at risk. Hence the whole reason for shipping me off to a sanatorium in the middle of the mountains, surrounded by woods and sealed with iron gates. Walling off the infection. Literally. But even though I'd read a lot about what was wrong with me, I'd read even more on how doctors couldn't do anything to fix it until scientists managed to develop a treatment that actually worked. Essentially, every doctor's appointment I'd had over the past few weeks had boiled down to this. The only thing to do was wait and see. Sanatoriums like Latham had statistically higher and faster rates of recovery than being quarantined in your bedroom, but they couldn't promise anything.
So, Dr. Barron said, how are we going to tackle your TB? While you're here at Latham, the best course of treatment is to follow your schedule.
My schedule?
He couldn't possibly mean the daily schedule I'd taped over my desk, which began with breakfast 8 a.m. and ended with lights out 9 p.m.
You'll find it in the front of your handbook, he continued, and I think you'll discover that having a routine gives you something outward to focus on. Rest periods are for resting quietly in your room or the common room if you're feeling up to it. Wellness periods are spent engaging in gentle physical activities like nature walks, lawn games, and yoga.
Yeah, sounds great, I said without enthusiasm.
Nap time and nature walks, the foolproof Latham treatment plan.
I'd known that going in, but there hadn't been a choice.
I couldn't stay at home. My parents were both teachers, and if either of them tested positive for exposure to what I had, the school board would be forced to fire them.
Dr. Barron smiled at me like he thought I was actually raring to go on a nature walk that very second.
Of course, you should still listen to your body. If you're feeling tired, spend your wellness time resting in bed. If you're feeling ill, check in at the nurse's station in your dorm. And of course, once a week, you'll check in with me so we can see how much progress you've made.
Once a week?
That seemed ridiculously drawn out, like I'd be at Latham forever.
Your hall nurse is available 24 hours a day.
He smiled, misunderstanding.
No, I mean, how long am I going to be stuck here?
I didn't realize what a dangerous question it was until I'd asked it, and Dr. Barron's smile widened.
That's a good question, Lane. First, we have to get your x-rays looking better. Wall off that pesky infection in your right lung. Make sure your hemoglobin levels have stabilized. And how long that takes is really up to you, not me.
Yeah, no kidding.
2 months? I pressed. 3?
I couldn't imagine being away for longer than that. In 3 months, I'd have missed the entire fall semester. Even with the binders of makeup assignments my teachers had sent over, I still wouldn't be able to keep up. Not in the advanced placement classes. And then I wouldn't get the scores I needed on the AP exams in the spring, and I wouldn't get college credit, which meant I'd have to take intro courses instead of skipping ahead to the classes I actually wanted.
What's so important that you need to get back for?
Dr. Barron's asked.
He had this condescending smile, and in that moment, I knew he wouldn't understand.
I was ranked 2nd in my graduating class. I'd almost killed myself to get there, too. I'd bussed over to the community college all of junior year for the AP Physics lab, volunteered at the health clinic on Wednesday afternoons, given up most of my weekends for Model UN practice and SAT prep courses, and started the Carbon Footprint Awareness Club after my advisor told me I needed to demonstrate unusual hobbies and passions to set my application apart. I was good at being smart, at studying the textbooks until I had them memorized, at knowing the right answer so often that I'd stopped raising my hand in class because I didn't need to prove anything. My parents had always pushed me to succeed, and after a while, I hadn't needed the push anymore. Until a couple of weeks ago, it was a straight shot to the college of my choice, to Stanford. I could land a summer banking internship at 20, graduate in 3 years, and recruit straight to Wall Street. I'd have my loans paid back by the time I turned 23, just in time for business school. Or law school. I wasn't quite sure yet. But that was the plan. And I intended to stick to it. Anyway, I healed fast. I'd recovered in a weekend when I got my wisdom teeth out, so I didn't have to miss the exam review in English. All I needed were a couple of weeks for my body to get its shit together, and then I could go home.
I didn't even feel that sick. I was a little tired, and I coughed sometimes. But it felt like having a cold, not some serious illness.
"Well, it's my senior year," I began.
"Lane," Dr. Behrens interrupted,
"what you need to do is to think of Latham as a vacation, a calm, welcoming place to relax and to escape from all the stresses and toxins of the real world."
"A vacation."
"Right,"
I said, my shoulders sagging.
I didn't do vacations. Vacations were for people who had time to relax, and I didn't. Stanford's acceptance rate was only 5%. I couldn't afford to be better than 94% of the other applicants. I had to be better than almost everyone.
But I could see that I wasn't getting through to Dr. Behrens about how important it was for me to stay on track. I'd have to show him that Latham was working, that I was improving, and then he'd send me home. I just had to make sure I wasn't too far behind when I got there.
Chapter 4. Sadie. I looked for Lane at dinner, wondering if I'd recognize him, and then I wondered if he'd recognize me. To be honest, I hoped he wouldn't. I'd been a total mess at 13, with frizzy hair and the wrong type of shorts and Deathly Hallows symbols inked onto my sneakers. But the thing about being a disaster in middle school is that the shame of it never fully goes away. Even after your braces are off and your hair is exactly the way girls wear it on Tumblr, underneath it all, you're still just as unsure whether someone actually likes you or is only talking to you so they can laugh about it afterward. And even though stuff like that never happened anymore, even though it had been years since I'd experienced anything you could really call bullying, I was still terrified I'd wake up one day and someone would declare everything about me totally and irreparably wrong. I knew it was dumb, but I didn't want some boy around who could tell embarrassing stories about me. I didn't want anyone to look at me and see Sadie Bennett, the outcast girl who sat alone in the arts and crafts tent making friendship bracelets for her American Girl doll. The cafeteria line inched forward, and I grabbed a turkey burger and two fruit cups. Nick snickered at me for taking two, and I was like, "Sorry for having an appetite." And that was when I saw him. It was him, after all. He was taller than I'd imagined, with unruly brown hair that seemed to defy gravity. He was pale and thin, which we all were, with dark circles under his eyes, and his clothes were too formal for Latham, like something you'd wear to a country club. But there he was, with his collared shirt untucked and a burger on his tray, talking to, Genevieve Reeser. A couple of days ago, in the hall bathroom, I was innocently brushing my teeth when Genevieve had come in with her face wash and cheerfully informed me that Jesus wants us to be ancestors of our future happiness by staying positive. I told her that Jesus wanted her to wait her turn for the sink. I watched as Genevieve led Lane back to her table of prayer group disciples. What a grim crowd. But it was always kids like that who volunteered to be tour guides. "What's with you?" Nick asked. "Nothing," I muttered. "I know him, that's all."
"Uh-oh, typhoid Sadie."
"Shut up, I meant when we were kids."
"Even worse,"
Nick smirked, shoveling a spoonful of sweet potato fries onto his plate. "Hey, Nick, do you know what it would say under your photo in a high school yearbook?" I asked. "Most likely to be friend-zoned."
"Funny," Nick grumbled. "Sharpen that wit of yours anymore, and someone might think you actually have a point."
I shot him my most serene smile. The truth was, most of us weren't in high school yearbooks. We were the ones who'd faded away, who hadn't come back in the fall, who might never come back. Because TB wasn't like cancer, something to be battled while friends and family sat by your bedside saying how brave you were. No one held our hands. They held their breath. We were sent away to places like Latham to protect everyone else because it was better for them. Maybe we should have anticipated it, the return of old things, the way history was starting to repeat itself. Spanish influenza came back first in 2009, although we called it swine flu. The whooping cough reappeared, then polio.
Then there was a meningitis outbreak at Princeton, some weird strain no one had seen before, which made the government import an emergency vaccine from Europe. Then Ebola. In the middle of this, a new strain of tuberculosis caught on, developing a resistance first to the drugs that had treated it, and then to the vaccine that had prevented it. And then it caught us. I know you're supposed to phrase it the opposite way, with patients catching the diseases, but that's never sounded right to me, as though instead of catching TB, I could have missed. Dinner was strange that night. Marina had been right. Something was unmistakably off, and everyone else was starting to sense it. I could feel the dining hall playing a giant game of guess who. "Was anyone supposed to go home today?" Marina asked. "I don't think so," Nick said. Marina's boyfriend, Amit, had gone home in July, and it had been 2 months of radio silence while Marina sent emails that were never returned and waited for a phone call that never came. Lately, when she saw someone celebrating their last night or packing their things into their parents' car, she went all mopey, and I didn't blame her. "But there's a lockout tonight," Charlie said, glancing up from his notebook long enough to register the weirdness. "Boys or girls?" Marina asked. "I'm not the Oracle of Death," Charlie told her. "I can't be that specific."
"It's not specific," I said. "You have a 50% chance of being right either way."
Then Nick started telling this story about how he'd accidentally farted in yoga that afternoon and had blamed it on this awful girl, Cheryl. And before I knew it, dinner was ending. We had these tall metal tray returns, the kind that are always full when you get to them, so it takes forever to find a slot for your tray. Miraculously, there was an open slot right in the middle. I shoved my tray in, and at the same moment, so did someone else from the other side. Our trays banged, the sound startling me. Mine came shooting back, and I managed to catch it before the plate slid off. "Sorry," someone called. It was a boy's voice. "Did I get you?"
"Colonel Mustard, in the dining hall, with a tray," I said. "That's how I died, if anyone asks."
"I'll let them know," he promised, popping his head around to my side. It was Lane. "So that's the murder weapon," he said mock seriously, nodding toward my tray. "Here, let me." His voice was low and gravelly, with just a hint of California to it. And the way he was staring at me was disconcerting. He couldn't stop staring at me. Maybe he wouldn't recognize me. Maybe the makeup and dry shampoo and skinny jeans had made me just another stranger in the dining hall. Before I could say anything, he took my tray and slid it onto the return. "Thanks," I murmured, relieved he hadn't made the connection. But then, who thinks you're going to run into someone you know on the downward slope of your own precarious fate?
"Sadie, right?" he said, smiling. "We, went to camp together."
"Damn it. We did?"
I frowned, like I couldn't place him. I knew that trick, at least. If you pretend not to remember someone, you immediately have the advantage.
"Camp Griffith," he prompted. "I was in 8B. I don't know if you'd remember me."
How could I forget? He'd been horrible to me at summer camp, unforgivably horrible. I had every right to dump the nearest tray over his head, and now he was acting like he thought I'd be pleased to see him?
"Lane?"
I said, pretending it had just dawned on me.
"Yeah."
I waited for him to say something, to apologize or at least bring it up. But he just stared at me, expectantly, with a grin that made him look like a kid, like he had when we were 13, with his badminton racket and cargo shorts.
"You got tall,"
I said, which was idiotic but too late to take it back.
"And sick, although I can see why you'd say tall."
He shrugged, still smiling.
"Sorry again about the tray."
"The tray?"
I said, thinking I hadn't heard him correctly.
"You can give me a strike or something for failing the tray return. I hear they're worth collecting."
"Why?" I asked, planning on skipping the social.
"Aren't you?"
He grinned like it was a private joke, but if it was, it wasn't funny. He didn't get to make jokes about missing dances. Not to me.
"I don't know,"
I said coldly. "Maybe I'll change my mind." All of a sudden, I was furious. Furious that he was here, that he was talking to me the way he never had when we were 13, that his acting nice was somehow 50 times worse than his being the asshole I was expecting. I didn't need his pity. I didn't want him feeling sorry for me and putting away my tray for me like I was too weak to lift it myself. Before he had a chance to respond, I walked away as fast as I could, not caring how my pounding heart would read on my med-sensor. The summer I'd known him had been the worst of my life. The summer of the divorce. The summer my parents had shipped my little sister away to Aunt Ruth's and packed me off to camp at the last minute so they could fight over selling the house without having to moderate the volume. I was sent away for 8 weeks, which would have been bad enough if the girls in my cabin hadn't all known each other for years. They weren't a cabin, they were a clique. And this one girl, Bethy, was the ringleader. I had a pink Disneyland sweatshirt, and the first week of camp she asked to borrow it. I was sitting on the porch